Before I introduce Patty, there's someone that came this afternoon that's very special to me, and she fought like heck to stay out of our fellowship, and we finally got her, and now she's one of our most enthusiastic members, and she just celebrated her first birthday. Will all of you clap and applaud for Joanne S.? Hey, Joanne. And now to introduce Patty. I have not heard Patty's tape, so I will be hearing her share her story for the first time, just as you will. What I do know about Patty is that she has a son, Patrick, whom she cares so much about that even though she left him only yesterday morning, she called from Atlanta yesterday evening to see how school was. And that's really a caring. I know that she has a sense of humor, because when I tried to call her, I thought I'd call. I don't like to write, and so I thought I would call and tell her that I would be at the airport to welcome her to Georgia. And I kept getting an answering service, and finally the operator let me hear the machine, and she said, this is Patty, and I'm at work, and I'm wondering why in the heck you're not. It was about 10:30 at night. So I decided, you know, maybe I better write a note after all. And last night I was teasing her about this, and she said, well, you ought to hear what I have on the tape now. She said, I have, just sort of summing it up, she said, I tell them that Patty and Patrick are not at home this weekend. We will not be back till Monday. But do not think you can come rob us, because our dog Killer is here looking after him. And then besides the sense of humor, I know that she is full of the love and fellowship of this program, because I have been with her since last night. And she got off the plane, and when she met, the first thing she did was hug me and Larry and Lonnie. So help me welcome Patty. I'm just... Patty. Patty O from Dana Point, California.
I'm Patty, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be sober and be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I haven't heard my tape either, so this is going to be the first time I hear my story while I'm sharing it with you. I have to tell you before I start that I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love what happens to people like me in rooms like this. I love the fellowship. I love the power. I love the magic. I love the laughter in the rooms, and it was your laughter that began to heal me long before your love could even touch me. And it wasn't always that way for me. I didn't love Alcoholics Anonymous when I walked through the doors. And I bet there's probably one or two other people sitting here today who didn't love Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard you talk about the feeling in the room. And I would sit and think, well, yeah, it's a little cold here this evening. Or it's a little warm. But that was the most I could get out of the feeling in the room. And I needed to stay sober a long time before I felt the feeling in the room. So if you're here today, I want you to know there's hope. And I hear a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous say, keep coming back. What I like to say is, don't go away. Just stay with us until the miracle happens for you. Whenever I have the opportunity to share at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, the story that I would like to tell you is I would like to tell you that I was a Kansas City housewife. I sat on the sofa and I drank a little white wine. One day I burnt the toast and I realized my life was unmanageable. So I rushed to Alcoholics Anonymous. I looked at the 12 steps of recovery. I knew they were the solution to my life. I worked them all in the first week and I skyrocketed to recovery. Now that's a story I'd like to tell you. Unfortunately, that isn't my story. If you're new here today, I want you to know that I didn't know I had a story until I had been sober for a while in Alcoholics Anonymous. If I would have known when I was drinking that I was going to end up in Alcoholics Anonymous with a story, I would have done some things a little differently. I came here and didn't understand. You talked about character defects. I didn't know what those were. I thought wetting the bed was weak kidneys. I thought going to jail stark naked was my protest against police brutality. I thought lying, cheating, stealing were assets. They were the things that had made me survive in life. I didn't have a clue as to what the people in Alcoholics Anonymous were talking about. What I did is I didn't drink, and I didn't go away, and I didn't die. And the miracle happened for me, and today I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't think of any place I would rather be than with one of you or in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, there's one place I'd rather be. I may get to that later. Some things don't change a lot. Pervert kind of stays with you forever. Before I get too carried away with myself, I want to thank Bo for inviting me. I'm always amazed when somebody asks me to come somewhere. The first thing I do is I call my sponsor and I say, wait, you're not going to believe this. Guess what happened? And the first thing that my sponsor does when I'm away is, in fact, happened today. I got up to the room and there was a message from my sponsor, and the message was, don't wear your high tops to the podium. This is a very gentle and a very loving woman. But I'm always impressed when somebody asks me to participate in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. When anybody asked me to come somewhere, I identified with Jimmy this morning. You weren't asking me to come somewhere for an awful long time. And I want to thank Betty and Lonnie for picking me up at the airport, and Betty for entertaining me last night. And we're 3 hours. You guys are off by 3 hours. And I got here. Your clock said it was 11. Mine said it was 8, and I wanted to play. And Betty stayed up with me for quite a while until we finally went up to our rooms. And I watched Lonnie last night break into his own car. Now that's the insanity of the disease of alcoholism. I'm a car thief. It was very difficult for me not to tell him what to do to get into his car. But I think if you're going to break into a car, get one that's nicer than the one that you drove up in. But he managed. I'm trying to recover. One of the things that, as I start with my story, the book talks about me in the very beginning. It says that we become dangerously, even dangerously antisocial. I didn't become that way. It started that way. And I had no social skills when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. When I got here, I thought going out to dinner was when the guy sitting next to you at the bar bought you a slab of beef jerky. And if he bought you a pickled egg, you had to go to bed with him. You know, that was about the extent of my social skills when I got here. And through the power of the 12 steps of recovery, I have become, and there's no one I sponsor here, so no one will disagree with this. The women I sponsor often tend to disagree with this statement, but since through the steps of recovery, I've become gentle, and I've become loving, and I've become kind, and I have manners, and I'm considerate. And now they're telling me that that's codependency, and I need to recover from that also. I guess it's a little confusing, but I was able to control my codependency last night and not tell Larry or tell Lonnie there was an easier way to get into his car. In fact, all of your cars are safe. I have had to give up car thieving. I did want to go to the mall, and they told me it was too far to walk. I saw the perfect car in the parking lot that I could have taken, gone to the mall, and come back, and you probably wouldn't have known it was gone. The magic for me in Alcoholics Anonymous is you have taken a liar, cheat, a whore, a thief, a rebel, and you have turned me into the person that I am today, and I love who I am today. I love who I am today. I'm thinking about writing the book, Women Who Love Themselves Too Much. I love the kind of person that I am. I need to do one thing. I have a friend in California who drank in Atlanta for a while, a number of years ago, and is looking for a woman whose last name is Hicks, and I can't remember the first name, who was drinking in Atlanta probably 12, 13 years ago. So if anybody knows who that person is, my friend has some amends to make and has given me power of attorney to make those amends, but asked me not to do it from a podium, which I may do anyway because that's the kind of person I am. I should probably drink here for a minute. I had my first drink of alcohol when I was 13 years old. I was raised in an alcoholic home. I had to come to Alcoholics Anonymous to discover that. I didn't know that I was raised in an alcoholic home. I didn't know that my father was an alcoholic. He was a pretty bizarre kind of fellow, but I didn't know that it had anything to do with alcohol. I had my first drink. I was on a camping trip with a group of girls, and I had no idea what alcohol would do to me or for me. I had no conceptions about alcohol. I didn't have any idea what it was or what it would do. But I was on this camping trip, and somehow I had gotten a hold of a bottle of vodka, and I had that bottle in my pillowcase. And that night when we went into the tent to go to bed, I took the vodka out of the pillowcase, and I asked if anybody wanted any of it. And none of them did. And the reason they gave me for not wanting it was all we had to mix with it was grape soda and root beer. And I said, well, so what? And I took the top off and I drank half the bottle. And I looked around and nothing had gotten different and nothing had changed. So I drank the second half of the bottle. And that was the end of my social drinking. Never again after that day did I offer anybody a drink out of my bottle. I finished that bottle and I sat there in that tent and everything was exactly the same as it had been before I drank it. And I remember being a little disappointed. Now, I didn't know what it was supposed to do, but it did nothing. And I sat there and I sat there, and after about 15 minutes, the only thing that happened was that I had to go to the bathroom. And I got out of the tent and I shuffled down the beach to the outhouse and I went in and went to the bathroom. And when I got done, I realized I was absolutely, totally, 100% paralyzed to the toilet seat. I couldn't move my eyelids. I didn't think my heart was beating. I didn't think I was breathing, and I was paralyzed, and I was overcome with an absolute sense of fear. And the fear was that somebody else was going to have to come use that outhouse, and there I was, paralyzed on the toilet seat. Now, later in my drinking, I was to discover that two people can use the same toilet at the same time if the second person is very careful about what they're doing. But I didn't know that then. I didn't know that then. So what I did was I got all the energy that seemed to be anywhere in my body. I got it all till I kind of got it all into one little ball, into one little central location. And when it all seemed to be gathered up, I just fell off the toilet, out the door, into the sand, and started crawling back to the tent. Now, since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I've discovered that my entire problem that night was my attitude. If my attitude would have been right, I could have had a fantasy that I was in the Marines and I was being dive-bombed as I was trying to get back to safety. And if my attitude would have been right, it could have been a wonderful experience. Now, in my own defense, I need to tell you that my pants were still down at my ankles. I had started to throw up and I couldn't quite get through it and I couldn't get around it. And under those circumstances, it was a little difficult to have a good attitude. I did manage to get back to the tent. I fell in. I passed out. I came to in the morning, and nobody was in the tent with me, and I couldn't figure that out for a minute until my eyes cleared enough that I realized I'd been sick all night long, and I had hit the top of the tent and the sides of the tent. I hadn't missed a square inch, and I didn't want to be in there either. I got out of the tent. And that was my first drink of alcohol, and I loved it. It was the most... It was the most wonderful, marvelous, incredible experience I have ever had, and it must have been because I put some amount of alcohol into my body on a daily basis for 13 years. I put some amount of alcohol into my body on a daily basis from that day until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't always drink the kinds of things that you would classify as a beverage. Jimmy talked about lemon extract. Vanilla extract was my favorite. I used to buy it by the six-pack. I would drink five bottles of it, and then halfway through the sixth bottle, I would suddenly remember what happened to me after a six-pack of vanilla extract. And what would happen to me is that my heart would start to beat really hard. I could see it coming on my chest. I would start to sweat, and then I would be freezing to death. And then my legs would get weak, and I'd fall to the ground, and then I'd be afraid I was going to die, and then I'd hope I was going to die, and then it was absolute hell for about 10 minutes. If you lived through the first 10 minutes, it was a wonderful high. But for me, that's what I believe the insanity of the disease of alcoholism is. It's not the things I did after I drank. It's what my head did or didn't tell me before I picked up the first drink. And it never reminded me about that first 10 minutes after a six-pack of vanilla extract. I remember the day I lived in a small town, the manager of the market called me over and he said, Patty, I can't let you buy vanilla extract anymore. He said, I can't believe anybody bakes as much as you do. And I got cut off. I drank a lot of mouthwash. I drank a lot of perfume. Taboo became my after-dinner drink of choice. I was one of those people that came to your house and ate and drank everything in your bathroom. It was just it was just how that was. And I left home. I went to college. I went to San Diego State College. I graduated from there with a 3.8 grade point average, drinking alcoholically on a daily basis. I'm one of those people that if I'm doing something well, I want to keep doing it, and so I took classes for a master's degree. I left San Diego State because I had taken all the classes San Diego State had to offer, and I really believed that. It never occurred to me that I was leaving because I had been arrested one more time for drunk driving assault. I had to come to Alcoholics Anonymous to find out you can get arrested for a single charge of drunk driving. I never knew that. I always got arrested for drunk driving assault. And it had something to do with how I got out of the car. It never occurred to me that was a drinking problem. I just figured that was a driving problem. And I was a bar drinker. I did all the things women bar drinkers do. I did a lot of things men bar drinkers do. I was never real particular about my behavior, but if you're a bar drinker, you've got to get home. And now I've developed this driving problem, so I would walk home from the bar. And a lot of those nights, I would get arrested for drunken public assault. And it never occurred to me it had anything to do with alcohol. It was you and they and them. It was circumstances and conditions. It was a lot of things. Never occurred to me it had anything to do with alcohol. And then one night I did this thing that I thought was clever. I still today think it was really clever. One night when they locked up the bar, I hid out when they locked it up. And that night I got arrested for breath assault. And it never occurred to me it had anything to do with alcohol. But I didn't think I was leaving San Diego because I had one more drunk driving assault charge pending. I didn't think I was leaving because I had a roommate who was a little annoyed with me. Now, this woman was really inconsistent. If you'd have drank if you lived with her. She was really, really inconsistent. But I have always had a tremendous amount of compassion. Now, the men who drank in the kind of bars that I drank in had very little creativity. They had two basic lines. My wife doesn't understand, and I have no place to sleep tonight. And that was generally the end of their dialogue. But I have all of this compassion. So some guy would come on to me with one of those lines, and I would say, listen, I'll take you home with me tonight, but I don't want to talk to you again until the bar closes. So the bar would close, being a lady of my word, I would take this guy home with me. We would get to my house. I would send him into the bedroom over here on the right, telling him I had to go to the bathroom. He would go into the bedroom on the right. I would go into my bedroom on the left, and I had just sent him in with my roommate. Now, some nights that was okay with her. Some nights it didn't bother at all. Other nights it would really annoy her. And within a matter of minutes, they were banging on my bedroom door, which I had of course, locked. I mean, I had to get some sleep. I had 7 o'clock classes. If it would have always been all right or never been all right, I would have been okay. But she was so inconsistent. And I didn't think I was leaving because she was annoyed with me. I didn't think I was leaving. There was a woman in San Diego. To this day, I pray that this woman has found Al-Anon and has released me. I was drinking one night and a man said something to me that I have never understood to this day. I don't understand. This man looked at me and he said, I've had too much to drink to drive. Now, I don't know about you, but I always drove a little better if I had a few drinks. I did not understand having too much to drink to drive. I told him I'd give him a ride home. So I load him into my car after the bar closed and I start driving him to his house and we drove. I always lived right around the corner from where I drank and this guy lived way, way out of town. We drove and we finally get to his house and he invited me in for a drink. Now I don't want to be rude. So I said, okay, I'll come in for a drink. Now my first clue that things may not have been all right. It says, we're walking up to the house, he says to me, now you have to be very quiet. Well, I just figured he had a roommate like mine who was really inconsistent. So we make the drinks, we go down the hallway to this bedroom. My second clue that things may not have been all right was that there were two twin beds in there, but he got those beds together so quickly, I hardly even noticed there had been two of them. And we started fooling around, and one thing led to another. God, I used to know what it led to. After a while I had to go to the bathroom, and so I leave the bedroom, I go to the bathroom, and now I am ready to play. I come back to the bedroom, I get to the door, I run across the room, I leap into the air, I do this Tarzan yell, and as I hit the bed, this woman started screaming so loud. And there I was, stark naked in bed with his wife. And Within a matter of minutes, he was at the door, stark naked, trying to explain to her I was his cousin. He hadn't seen me in 10 years. And we're trying to get reacquainted, and this lady is not going for any of it, and all I want to do is get out of there. And this woman is looking for me to kill me. And I don't think that's why I'm leaving. I think I'm leaving San Diego because I have taken all the classes San Diego State had to offer. And so I loaded up my car with everything I owned. I took 2 cases of beer, 2 bottles of booze, and I left San Diego, which is in Southern California, and I headed for Chico, California, Northern California, and I started to drive. I got 66 miles north of San Diego, and I was out of booze, and I was thirsty. So I pulled off the freeway, and I don't know about you, but I have a sense I can find the sleaziest bar in town without even looking for it. I pulled into the parking lot of this place. I walked in. There was sawdust on the floor. Somebody had vomited at the front door several weeks before then. The room was full of that smell that only a sleazy bar has, that kind of urine and used booze smell. It still makes me salivate to think about it. It was full of smoke. Willie Nelson was singing on the jukebox, and I knew I was home. I sat down, I ordered a drink, and that's as far north as I ever got, 66 miles from where I started from. And I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I didn't know that at 13 years old I had put alcohol into an alcoholic body, and from that day on I had no choice. Alcohol controlled where I would live, where I would work, the people I would run with, and eventually the people I would run from. And I didn't have a clue. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous as a direct result of one more drunk driving assault charge. The sheriff in Orange County, California has absolutely no sense of humor. I'm one of those people, I get arrested, I get released, I read the arrest report, I see where I made my mistake so I can practice that part so that next time I'll get that part right. And you see, I always knew there'd be a next time. I always knew there'd be a next time. So I practiced field sobriety tests a lot. And by the time I got stopped this last time, I was doing very well on field sobriety tests. I knew where to touch with what and how to do it and what to say. And I had given myself an A+. I was really doing a fine job. And at the end of the test, he asked me to say the ABCs backwards. And the time before that, I had responded with, well, I can't even do that sober. Well, then I had just confessed, right? And they cuffed me and took me off. So this time, when he asked me to say the ABCs backwards, I said, okay, and I turned around and I went, ABCs. So you think it's funny. He didn't think it was funny. I was turned around, and he cuffed me, and he took me to Orange County Jail, and he put me in a cell with criminals. And I knew I didn't belong there. I mean, there were prostitutes in there, there were thieves in there, there were women who had been arrested for beating their husbands, which I don't think should be a crime, but they seemed to lock you up for it anyway. I mean, there were real criminals in there, and I didn't belong there. And so what I did was I tried to organize a prison break. And I very carefully explained my plan to the criminals. We're going to take our coffee cups, we're going to bang them on the bars, we're going to make a lot of noise, and when the marshal comes to see what's going on, I'm going to throw my arm out around the bars, get her around the neck, get her keys, and we're going to get out of here. And I explained it very carefully and very slowly. And I heard something that I was to hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of those criminals looked at me and she said, why don't you sit down and shut up? And I said, fine, then y'all stay, but I'm getting out. I got my coffee cup, I was going like a mad woman on those bars. There's a couple problems with styrofoam cups. The first one is they don't make a lot of noise. The second one is the bars have a tendency to eat them up. And when the bars ate them up and they got to my knuckles and it got painful, I sat down and I shut up. And several hours later, they came to the cell and they called my name and they were releasing me on an OR. And I hadn't been released from jail on an OR in a very long time. And I knew they were making a mistake, but I wasn't going to be the one to tell them about it. And they took me to a telephone, and they told me I could make one phone call. I stood at that telephone for 5 minutes. I could not think of one person who I could call to come pick me up from Orange County Jail. I certainly couldn't call anybody in my family. And there was nobody who I considered a friend that I could call to come pick me up. And I stood at that phone, and I knew isolation and loneliness, and I didn't know that's what I knew. And after about 5 minutes, the name of a woman who had worked for me at one time went through my head. And with that alcoholic arrogance, I called her, and I didn't ask her. I told her to come pick me up from Orange County Jail, and she did. And she took me back to where my car was. And as I was getting out of her car, she looked at me, and she said, Patty, I don't ever want to see you again. I don't want to hear from you, and I don't want to hear about you, and as far as I'm concerned, you no longer exist. And if she drove off, I gave her one of these, and I thought, then fine, I'll do it myself. You see, I've been raised all my life to know that if I needed something done, then I better go do it. I didn't need you or they or them. And if I couldn't do it, it didn't need to get done, and I didn't need her, and I didn't need you, and I didn't need anybody. And I got in my car that morning, I did the only thing I knew how to do. I went to the bar, and I told the guys how they had done it to me one more time. One more time, it was you and they and them. One more time, it was circumstances and conditions. One more time, it was a lot of things. Never occurred to me it had anything to do with alcohol. I went to court on that drunk driving assault charge, and because of my record, that was my 12th, and I had stood in front of a judge a number of times for some other things, and based on my record, the judge was sentencing me to 10 years in jail. I was 26 years old. I have a son that's a direct result of my alcoholism. I never wanted to be a mother. I found out that is not adequate birth control. My son was 8 months old at the time, and I didn't like him at all. He did nothing but wet and cry. He would not go get a job. He interfered with my life a lot, and I didn't like him one bit. But I was willing to use him that morning, and I explained to the judge standing there in that courtroom at 26 years old and drunk, that's the only way I ever went to court, it's the only way I went to school, it's the only way I went to work, it's the only way I went to the grocery store, it's the only way I did anything. Standing there drunk that morning, I explained to the judge how he couldn't put me in jail because I was a single parent and I was self-supporting through my own contributions and I had this 8-month-old baby that I needed to take care of. And the judge told me that I was going to jail and that he would put my son in a foster home because I was an unfit mother. Now, I would have admitted to being a lot of things. I knew I was a lot of things. I could not believe that I was an unfit mother. I had that kid with me. I got him up at 6 in the morning whether he wanted to get up or not. I dressed him. I put him in one of those plastic things that you put kids in when you don't want to touch him. And I took him with me down to the bar. Now, I'm not proud of this, but he was to spend the first 11 months of his life in one of those plastic things sitting on a pool table in the smoke-filled bar. My son is eternally grateful that I'm sober today. Mostly he's too big to fit in one of those plastic things anymore. And I believe that because I had him with me, made me a fit mother. And he was going to a foster home, and I was going to jail. Now, I was 26 years old. I had been to jail. I know how to do jail. There is more drugs and alcohol inside the institution than there are some days on the street. If you know what to do, who to do it to, and you're willing to go to any lengths, and I always was. And for some reason that morning at 26 years old, I had what I know today is a moment of clarity. Just standing there drunk, I knew that if I went to jail one more time, I would either die in the institution or I'd become institutionalized for life. And I didn't know why I knew that. And I was being sentenced to 10 years. And in the middle of sentencing me, something happened. And I knew the judge was as surprised at what he was saying as I was at what I was hearing. Because in the middle of sentencing me, the expression on his face changed. The tone of his voice got different. And he looked down at me and he said, I know this won't work for you, but I'm going to offer you one more chance. And he offered me an alternative. And part of that alternative was meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I wish I could tell you I came here that day, looked at the 12 steps to recovery, knew they were the solution to the problems in my life, worked them all in the first week and skyrocketed to recovery. But that isn't my story. I drank for 3 more months. In retrospect, I can tell you that I drank with a sense of urgency and a desperation that I had never known before. I couldn't have drank a greater quantity of alcohol. Physically, it would have been impossible to drink a greater quantity. But I drank with a sense of urgency and a desperation that I had never known. And on October 4th, 1975, the day before I was to go back to court to tell the judge what it was I was doing with the alternative he gave me, on that day I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know what A&A was. I thought it was maybe something like the PTA or Parents Without Partners. And a lot of days it is. But I had no idea what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I didn't know what you people were going to do to me or for me. I had no idea. I don't believe I had ever heard the words Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was a Sunday, and I went to my first meeting. It was a speaker meeting, and there were probably 200 people in that meeting. And in that meeting, I heard two things. I heard we don't drink between meetings. Now, if you're new, or I don't know how that affects you, but it made me real nervous. Now, I was a bar drinker. I had retired when I was 25. I always thought if you're going to retire, you should do it while you're young and you can have a good time. I had to stay sober for a long time to find out that the reason I wasn't working is because I was unemployed and unemployable. I had drank myself out of my profession, and that's why I wasn't working. I just simply believed that I had retired. And if you're retired and you're a bar drinker, what do you do with all your time if you don't drink? So that made me a little nervous. I heard you say alcohol was the problem. Alcohol wasn't a problem for me. Alcohol was a solution for me. Alcohol was the thing that made it okay for me to be out there. It was the thing that made it okay for me to go to work and to go to school and to go to the laundromat and to go to the grocery store. Alcohol was a solution for me. I didn't understand when you talked about alcohol being a problem. The other thing that I heard in that meeting was that the answers were in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So after the meeting, I stole the book. I mean, God knows I need to have the answers. I can't tell you how upset I was when I got home. Not only could I not find the answers in that book, I couldn't even find the questions. And I thought, oh dear God, I've stolen the wrong book, and I'm going to have to go back and get the right one. And that bothered me a lot. The thing that was different about that day, and I didn't realize it for quite a while, the thing that was different about that day was I didn't drink and I didn't use. And I didn't plan it that way. I never planned to go a day without drinking. The book in chapter 3 talks about the ways that we tried to control our drinking. I never tried to control my drinking. I am a good drinker. Never did I try to control my drinking. Every once in a while I would try to control my behavior, but I never tried to control my drinking. It never occurred to me to even cut down, much less to not drink. I never occurred to me to not drink. And yet on October 4th, 1975, the day that I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't drink and I didn't use. And because that was my experience, I know that my sobriety was a gift from a very gentle and a very loving God, because I didn't plan it for myself. My court program said I had to go to 2 meetings a week. I thought that was a little excessive. As a matter of fact, I couldn't figure what you had left to tell me. You'd already told me I couldn't drink, and the answers were in the book. What else was there possibly for you to tell me? But I was willing to go to any length to stay out of jail. That's all I wanted out of this deal, was to stay out of jail, and I was willing to go to any length. So I was willing to go to 2 meetings a week. On Wednesday, with 4 days of sobriety, I went to my second meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was a small discussion meeting. And in that meeting, I heard, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. And I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I could not figure out what it was that you had that you thought was so hot that I should be willing to go to any length to get it. Some of you had nice cars. I know how to get those. Some of you had nice jewelry. I knew how to get that. As a matter of fact, if you stood next to me during the Lord's Prayer, if your rings were loose, they were mine. And nice spouses, I knew how to get those. I could not figure out what it was you had that was so hot. And then I saw him. And I truly believe there's a him for each of us. This guy was a skinny little fellow. He was bald-headed. He wore baggy pants with a thin belt. He had tennis shoes on with no shoelaces, but the holes were there where they should have been. And he nodded out during the meeting. And I thought, if I have to do this and not drink, I want to do it his way. And so I found out where he was working, and I snuck down to his office the next day, and I went in and I said, Dick, I have to do this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous to stay out of jail, and I don't know how to do it. And he told me if I would go to meetings and read the book and talk to other alcoholics and not drink, which I'll guarantee you won't get drunk. And if you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And I'm grateful he told it to me that way. He didn't tell me my life would get better. He didn't tell me my relationships would get better, my finances would get better, my job life would get better, my family life would get better, my sex life would get better. He didn't tell me any of it would get better, and I'm grateful, because none of it has. I'd like to give a little hope to the newcomer. But it's all gotten different. And as I stand here this afternoon, I can tell you from the top of my head to the tip of my toes, I have never had it so good. If I'd have had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. You see, I don't know good from bad for me. If I'm going through something that I think is good for me, it generally turns out to be bad for me. If I'm going through something that I think is bad for me, it generally turns out to be good for me. And I don't know good from bad for me. But I sure do know what different is, and every area of my life is different than it was the day I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have never had it so good. If I'd have had it my way, I'd have sort of changed myself, because all I came here for was to stay out of jail. That's all I wanted out of this deal. And I believed him, and I don't know why I believed him. I hadn't believed a human being in a very long time. But I believed that man that day, and I left his office and thought, well, I've already got the book, so I might as well read it. So every night I'd open it to chapter 3, and I'd read, most of us are unwilling to admit we are real alcoholics, and I'd say amen and close the book, and that was reading the book. We have a club in Laguna Beach. I'd go into the club, and I'd have a cup of coffee, and on the way out, I'd say hi to Jim, the manager, and he'd say hi, Patty, and I was talking to another alcoholic. As obsessive as I thought it was, I went to the 2 meetings a week that my court program said I had to go to. And the only thing I did right is I didn't drink and I didn't use. And for me, it took 8.5 months of not drinking to get far enough away from my last drink to see the evidence of my alcoholism. It took 8.5 months of not drinking to get far enough away to see the evidence of my alcoholism. It was piled this high. You all saw it when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. You knew when I walked in that I belonged here. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in a pair of Levi's that had never seen the inside of a washing machine, and I was really quite proud of that. I had on a t-shirt, I wore an old Coast Guard pea coat, I wore dark glasses all the time, I wore my hair down in my face, only my nose showed. I had no shoes on. Now I know I had had some at one time, but I couldn't quite figure out where I had left them. And that's how I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had that smell that only a newcomer walking through these doors has. And you all knew I belonged here when I walked in, regardless of what I told you. I told you about, I didn't identify with you. You were down and out. You had lost everything. I hadn't lost anything. I told you about what my profession. I told you about the big oak desk that I sat at. I told you about the trophies and the plaques on the wall that said I was good at what I did. What I didn't tell you about was the mornings at 5 a.m. that I would come to wrapped around the leg of that desk with the cleaning lady coming in. And I don't know anybody but an Al-Anon who enjoys the sound of a vacuum cleaner. But she'd be coming in. She'd be coming in with the vacuum cleaner, and I'm wrapped around the leg, and I know there's a bottle in that drawer, and if I can just get to it, I'm going to be okay. And I'm trying to tell her I don't need my office cleaned today. I like it like this. I didn't tell you about those mornings. I didn't tell you about the times that I would come to standing at a podium much like this in a large room full of people holding an award and not knowing if I was giving it or receiving it. And I would come out of a blackout, look around and say thank you and go sit down, and then somebody would elbow me and tell me I was giving it to somebody from the Junior Women's League and I'd have to come back up. And I didn't tell you about that stuff. I just simply forgot about that stuff for a while in Alcoholics Anonymous. But you let me do what I had to do for as long as I had to do it. You gave me the dignity to do exactly what I had to do for as long as I had to do it, until I could get far enough away from my last drink to see the evidence of my alcoholism and admit to my innermost self that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had become unmanageable. And that, for me, was the first step in recovery. And, God, I wish I could tell you then that I looked at the other 11 steps and worked them all and skyrocketed to recovery. I need to tell you that I have never done anything until my back was against the wall. The pain was so great, it was do it or die, and I had no other choice. Under those circumstances, I become very willing to work the next one of the 12 steps of recovery. The book says that I should tell you what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. So what happened for me is the 12 steps of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, and so I'd like to talk about the steps just for a minute. Well, actually, that's a lie. It's going to be more than a minute because there's 12 of them. The what happened for me is the 12 steps. The thing that changed my life, the power, the magic that made me the person that I am today, is the 12 steps of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. Step two for me was, I was raised Catholic, and I'm still recovering from that. I have been sober, though, long enough to know that it wasn't all the Catholic Church. I have always had, still today, I have a hearing problem. A lot of times it isn't what you say, it's how I hear it. What I heard the nuns say was I heard them say that I was going to burn for just as long for thinking it as I was for doing it. Now, I have always been a kind of into action person. So I would have a thought, and I thought if I'm going to burn for thinking it, I would do it. I'd have a thought, and I'd do it. I'd have a thought, and I have done things that I didn't even want to do. I knew they were disgusting ahead of time. But I would have the thought, and I would take the action. What I came to believe in step two was I came to believe the day would come that I could have a thought and I wouldn't have to take an action on it. And I'm happy to tell you that's happened for me. I'm an alcoholic. I will always be an alcoholic. Every once in a while I have an idea that a drink would be nice. When I have that thought, what I do is I clap, I say thank you for your participation, and I just go about whatever it is that I'm doing. And I can have the thought and not have to take an action on it. I've had 2 major lust attacks since I've been standing up here this afternoon, and so far I haven't had to take action on either one of them. I think a lot. I hear in Alcoholics Anonymous, I hear people say, don't think. I don't know about you, but I think all the time. I am eternally grateful that God did not put a loudspeaker on my head so that what I was thinking came barreling out to the world. I'm sharing with you, I'm thinking about something else. I think all the time. It says in the book that God gave us brains to use, and I believe that. I have stayed sober based on some really strange thinking that I've had. When I was new, I thought AA had bar patrol. Now, I'm here on a court card. If I mess up, I'm looking at 10 years in jail, right? I think AA has bar patrol. I think you all meet here, and then after your little meeting, you go off, and because I see it, I mean, I see after meetings, you go off in groups. Now, I knew where you were going. You were going to the bars in the area. Y'all had your little area bars that you went to check. And you went to the bars, and if you found one of your members in there, you grabbed them by the back of the neck, totally embarrassed them in front of their peers, and yanked them out of the bar. I don't know where the thought came from, but I'll tell you what, it kept me sober. Long enough to get far enough away from my last drink to see the evidence of my alcoholism. I have had a lot of real strange thoughts. I am grateful they don't lock you up for what you think. Because step 2 has worked in my life, I haven't been locked up since I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't get locked up for what I think. I don't get judged on my intentions. It's not my motives that count. It's what I do. It's what I do. It's action for me. It's what I do. And I have been restored to sanity as a direct result of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hear people in Alcoholics Anonymous talk about having trouble with step 3. I had no problem with step 3. When my back was against the wall, the pain was so great, it was do it or die, and I had no other choice. I looked at step 3 and saw that it said, made a decision. Well, I don't know about you, but I'm a great decision maker. I make 1,000 decisions a day. I'm really good at making decisions. What I have trouble with is taking the action to implement the decision. That sometimes gives me some grief. But I have no problem making a decision. And then I realized I turned my will and my life over to the care of alcohol and drugs on a daily basis for 13 years. I've turned my will and my life over to the care of people even less qualified than myself a number of times. I've turned my will and my life over to the care of a lot of things. When the pain was so great I had no other choice, it was a simple matter for me to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. I am happy to tell you that that didn't happen for me until I got to the 11th step. And I'm grateful for that because my idea, my understanding, my concept of God has changed over and over and over and over since I made that decision. The God that I have today is not the one that I grew up with. And the God that I have today, I believe, is not the one that I'm going to have, you know, somewhere else down the road. But my will and my life, that didn't happen to me until I got to the 11th step, and I'm grateful for that. Step 4, my degree is in journalism. I'm a writer by training. I thought step 4 was for those of you who have no creative writing skills. I thought those of you who weren't writers needed to write, just to brush up on your creative writing skills, you needed to write an inventory. I certainly didn't have to do it. And I didn't do it, and I didn't do it, and I didn't do it. And when I was a little over a year sober, I was at the Canyon Club, this AA club in Laguna Beach, and a fellow who'd been around for about 20 days came into the club, and he drank that day. And I sat and talked to him for about 45 minutes, and then I had to go to the bathroom, so I got up and went to the bathroom, and when I came back, he was gone, and I asked somebody where he went, and he said he left. So I went out to the parking lot, and he was in his car, and I asked him if he was okay, and he said, yeah, I'm going to go home and sleep it off. He said, but I'll be back tomorrow. And I said, well, I hope so, because I love you. And I was 27 years old. I was a little over a year sober. I had never said the words, I love you, in my entire life. My parents told me they loved me. They told me I was being raised with love. Any more of their love, and I'd have died. Their love was physically, emotionally, and mentally abusive. As a small child, that's what I thought love was. I came to believe that love was something very painful. If I loved you, I would have to hurt you. And if you loved me, you were going to hurt me. And at 4 years old, I had made a commitment to never love another human being.
And I had never said the words, I love you, in my entire life. And that night at 27 years old, a little over a year sober, when I said those words to that man, I didn't know what they meant. But I knew what it felt like, and it felt good. And as he drove out of the parking lot, I started to cry, and I hadn't cried since I was 8 years old. And the line in chapter 5 that says, those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to a simple program. That line went through my head, and I knew that if I was to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have to give myself completely to this simple program. And that night, I made a choice to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous. See, my sobriety was a gift, and my recovery has been a choice, and I have continued to choose to recover on a daily basis. And because I had chosen to recover, I was going to AA meetings every night. Every night I'd come here and sit with you and laugh. And every night I'd come and sit with you and share. Then all of a sudden, one night I came to a meeting in pain. I sat in the middle of you and I felt isolated and alone. I felt separate from, I felt different, I felt unique. I knew there was no sense sharing with you because you weren't going to understand anyway. My problems were different. And I left in more pain than I had walked in with. And the next night I came to a meeting in pain. I sat in the middle of you and felt different and isolated and alone. Knew there was no sense in sharing and left in more pain than I had come in with. And I did that night after night after night after night. Until the pain of sitting with you was so great that I knew I would have to leave Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew I couldn't stay here any longer. I couldn't stay here in the kind of pain that I was in. And I got up to leave Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had one of my thoughts. And the thought was, why don't you try writing the fourth step before you leave? Before you leave, just go home and try this thing. So I went home that night, and I wrote my inventory exactly the way it says to do it in the book. If you're lazy, that's the best way to do it. It is so simple. I wrote it that night in a matter of just an hour or so. I didn't write anything that I didn't already know. No secrets came flying out of my pen. Everything I wrote down, I already knew about myself. And when I finished writing it, I felt a part of it, and I knew I belonged in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have always been a little different, but I knew you would understand because you were a little different, too. And I felt at home in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I looked at step 5, and I thought, there's so many Catholics in Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought step 5 was for those of you who aren't Catholic. You could have the experience with confession that we all knew about, and we knew it didn't work. And we figured, I figured you needed that experience, so you would know it doesn't work either, and I certainly wasn't going to do it. And I put my fourth step in the trunk of my car, in case anybody might come to my house and find it, and I drove around with a continual sense of impending doom. And the fear was, I mean, that we were ended on the highway, my trunk was going to fly open, and my fourth step would be over. Anywhere. Now, rather than do a fifth step, I chose to drive that way for a very long time. And then one night I was in Los Angeles visiting a friend of mine, and we were talking, and suddenly it occurred to me that I was doing the fifth step. Now, I would not have picked this woman to do a fifth step with. My program was not red hot. Hers was worse than mine. Plus, she had 2 weeks less sobriety than I did, and I would not have picked her to do a fifth step with. But because I was doing it, I figured if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it right. And I went to the car, and I got my fourth step. And because of that experience, I know that God will always put the person in front of me that I need to share with. Because you see, I finished my fifth step, and she looked at me, and she said, Patty, one day the things that you think are your greatest assets will become your greatest liabilities. And the things that you think are your greatest liabilities will become your greatest assets. And I thought, oh, wonderful, I have just done a fifth step with a woman who has lost her last marble. I need to tell you the things that I have always thought were my greatest assets, and Alcoholics Anonymous become my greatest liabilities. And the things that I thought were my greatest liabilities become my greatest assets here. And I don't know how that happened. An example of that is that I am a very strong woman. I have always been a really strong woman. That strength has always been an asset for me. And Alcoholics Anonymous becomes a liability because you see, when you're a strong woman, and I imagine it's true if you're a strong man. I've just never met one to confirm it with. But I don't know what, if you ever stand up here, it's kind of like God just does it. You really don't have any control over what you say. But what happens is that it's very difficult to ask for help. It's very difficult if you're a strong person to ask for help. Whenever I try to do anything alone on a regular basis, it's not doing anything alone, but asking one of you to help me, to walk with me, to do it with me. And that asset here becomes a liability because when I'm strong, I shortchange myself. When I do it alone, I shortchange myself. I went home from doing step 5 and I did step 6 and 7 by mistake. I really didn't mean to do them. It was really an error that I did those steps, but
The book Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't have to be a journalism major to know that that book is very poorly written. Any newcomer will tell you that the book Alcoholics Anonymous is very poorly written. But the part right around steps 6 and 7 gets real poetic, and it's real short. And it's just this little paragraph, I read that, and then I start reading this, and then all of a sudden, I'm hooked into it, and when I realized what I was reading, I was in the middle of the 7-step prayer. And when I realized what I was reading, I knew that I believed what it said, and I finished reading the prayer, and the thing that it says in the book happened to me. I walked through the archway to freedom. I finished reading that prayer, and I walked away from the person I had been all of my life to start to become the person God intended for me to be. The best I have ever described myself, when I came here, I was an animal with latent human tendencies. When I finished reading that prayer, I walked away from that person to start to become the person God intended for me to be, and I never have to be that person again. One day at a time, as long as I continue to choose to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous, I never have to go back and be that person again. For me, that's the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. If that hasn't happened for you yet, please stay with us long enough. Please stay here until you have the opportunity to walk away from the person you've been all of your life and start to become the person God intended for you to be. Steps 8 and 9 for me are simply conventional ways of getting rid of conventional guilt. I already had my list for my 4th step. So with that alcoholic arrogance, I said, all right, God, if you want me to make amends to these fools, you put them in my face because I am not going looking for them. I want to tell you, people started showing up this quick. I had people in my face for their amends who I had forgotten completely about, and I had to quickly put them on the list so I could make my amends. And it started showing up, and it started having an opportunity to make those amends. I had 2 amends to make that could have put me back in jail for a very long time. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to stay out of jail. That's all I wanted out of this deal. And yet I had 2 amends to make that could have put me back for a very long time. And God loved the people in Alcoholics Anonymous and told me I didn't have to make the amends. He pointed to the part in the book where it said, if another person will be harmed, you don't need to make the amends. He reminded me I was still a single parent. My son was still living with me. I needed to take care of him, that he would be harmed. And I love you for that, but I'm the only person who lives in my gut. I'm the only person who lives right here. And I knew that I needed to make those amends. I brought my son to Alcoholics Anonymous with me. He was 11 months old when I got sober. I would bring him to meetings. You would take him in your lap and hold him and bounce him and whatever you did with him. And I'd bring him to another meeting, and one of you would hold him, and you loved him, and you loved him. You didn't love me when I was new, but you tolerated me, and I'm grateful for that. When you could, you started to love me, and then you taught us how to love one another. And I knew, and everything my son knows, he's learned from you. I couldn't teach him about love. I didn't know anything about it. He's learned understanding, he's learned compassion, he's learned honesty. He's also learned how to con and manipulate, but I guess he gets the good with the bad. Everything he knows, he's learned from you, and I didn't come here for that. And I'm eternally grateful, but I knew that if I needed to go to jail, that my son would be taken care of, that one of you would take him, and he would be all right. And I live with what I feel like in here, and I needed to go make those amends. And I'm the coward that came here to stay out of jail. That's all I wanted out of this deal. And I went off to make those amends, and I can't tell you how it happened, because there's absolutely no way on the face of the earth that it should have turned out this way. But I went and made those amends, and I didn't need to do a single day. I didn't do a single day for those amends, and by all rights, I should have gone away for a very long time. And when I finished making those amends and walked out of that courthouse, I had a freedom that I had never known before. I walked out of that courthouse with my feet on the ground, eyeball to eyeball with every other human being. I walked out of that courthouse, I had finally, through the steps, come out of that pit of incomprehensible demoralization. I had finally, as a result of the steps, walked up out of that dark, desperate place to a point where I could stand on the ground and look eyeball to eyeball with every other human being. For the first time in my life, I was right with you. And because I was right with you, I was right with God. And because I was right with God, I was right with myself, and I had never been that way. It had never been enough. It had never been the right kind. If I only had that job and that car and that bank account and that relationship, I would be all right. And we're great getters. We can get that stuff really good. I would get it. And it wasn't enough, and it wasn't the right kind. I needed that job. I needed that car. I needed to live there, and I would be all right. And it was never enough. It was never the right kind. I'm the kind of person I can use a year's supply of anything in 2 weeks. It is never enough. When I finished making those amends for the first time in my life was exactly enough, and it was exactly the right time. Now, that doesn't mean I don't want more. greed, which has always been a liability, becomes an asset for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I look in your eyes and I know there's more available and I want it all today. I don't want to shortchange myself anymore. I want it all. And so that greed keeps me coming back here night after night after night to keep what I have and to get what you have. But it is right today and it's exactly the right time, and it has never been that way for me. Steps 10, 11, and 12 are, people call them maintenance steps. I don't know about you, but I had nothing to maintain. Steps 10, 11, and 12 for me are growth steps. Steps 10, 11, and 12 for me are the gifts that you've given me that allow me to come here on a daily basis and listen to you share your experience, strength, and hope with me. Steps 10, 11, and 12 are the steps that give me the privilege of sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and listening to you share with me how to live life. And when I come here and listen to you share with me how to live life, I don't have to shortchange myself anymore. I can live life to the fullest today. Step 10 for me is I have a very difficult time admitting that I'm wrong. I just have a struggle with that. But when it happens, which is rare, I don't think I've been wrong yet this year, but my pain threshold is very, very low. I used to have this incredible pain threshold. It's very low today. I can't get away with much. The path gets narrower the longer we stay here. I can't get away with much today. When I do something that makes me uncomfortable, you have given me a tool that I can take care of it right now. I don't wait till the end of the day. The end of the day is too long for me. I can take care of it right now and keep my side of the street clean so I never have to start slipping back into that pit of desperation and despair again. I never have to get to a place where I can't look in your eyes anymore and I can only tell who you are by the shoes you wear. As long as I use step 10 on a daily basis, I can keep my side of the street clean and I can live life to the fullest and I can enjoy who I am and who you are. Step 11 for me, I have always been a very simple person. I'm still real simple. My prayer in the morning is very simply, thy will be done. And I am so naive that I believe after I say that prayer that the rest of my day is God's business. My job is to not drink and to show up and to live life, and the rest of it is God's business. I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that I'm supposed to be here this afternoon, because if I wasn't, I would be somewhere else. And I believe you're supposed to be here, because if you weren't, you would be somewhere else too. And that's how simple I am. Meditation for me has become, I use meditation for medical reasons, and yet in the love of Alcoholics Anonymous has saved my life more than once. Step 12, I hate 12-step calls. Why doesn't anybody want to get sober at noon? You know what I mean? They always seem to want to get sober 1, 2, 3 in the morning. And Central Office in Orange County, and how they know this is beyond me. 99% of the time I sleep alone. Now, sometimes when I share that, I get a little sympathy. Somehow, Orange County Central Office knows the 1% of the time that I have overnight company. And that's the night my phone rings at 12, 1, 2 in the morning. And I hate it. I hate getting out of my warm bed. It's always cold when you get up. You know that she doesn't want to get sober anyway. She just wants somebody to talk to. You call up, you know, you talk, you're going to come over, you hate it, there's hate in my voice, I hate it. I call one of the women I sponsor, usually one who has recently gotten into a relationship. I figure if I'm going to suffer, she's going to suffer. I mumble all the way to my car because it's cold, and then I get over and pick her up, and we might bitch and moan all the way over to the house, and I know this woman doesn't want to get sober, and she's not sincere, and if she was sincere, she'd wait till noon, and I just am I hate it. And I walk up to the house and I hate it. And I knock on the door a little bit harder than you really need to knock on the door, and I hate every second of it. Until the door opens and I look in the eyes and I see the pain and I see the fear and I see the degradation and I see the demoralization of the female alcoholic. I look in the eyes and I see everything in those eyes that were my eyes when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I look in the eyes, I know that it is the greatest gift that you have ever given me, is an opportunity to share my dark, ugly, sordid past with another human being. It is the greatest gift that you have ever given me. And I'd have missed it all. I'd have missed every second of it, because all I came here for was to stay out of jail. That's all I wanted out of this deal. And I have gotten so much more. My life is full today. I'm going to tell you where I am today, and then I'm going to stop. I My son still lives with me. He's 13 years old. I'm thinking of starting a new support group, SPA, Sober Parents of Adolescents. I love him. I love him. This little tiny baby that I kept in that plastic thing that I couldn't stand, he still won't go get a job, but because of you, and because of the power of this program, and because of what you, the 12 Steps, and God have done with both of us, my son is my best friend today. I absolutely love him. He was in, I don't know, fifth or sixth grade, and they had a Mother's Day luncheon at his school, and the kids cooked the food, which I thought was great, because somebody in my family needs to know how to cook. And they invited them, you know, the mothers, and it's just such a privilege for me to dress up and to go to his school and participate in his life, because by all rights, I shouldn't be there. By all rights, somebody else should have been at that luncheon, you know, and I go there, and we're in line to get our food, and we're talking, and we're just doing what we do. And we got up to the table to get our food, and the teacher looked at me and she said, "The two of you look like young lovers." And I said, "We are." And we got our food and we went and sat down, and I looked around the room and I wondered what the difference was. I knew that those other mothers loved their kids, and I knew the kids loved their mothers, and I wondered what the difference was. And all of a sudden it occurred to me that those women never had, opportunity is probably the wrong word, that they never had, they never drank themselves into that pit of incomprehensible demoralization. They never drank themselves into that pit of despair. They never drank themselves in that hopeless, helpless place that we all came from. And because of that, they had never been given 12 simple steps to walk out of that pit and to stand on the ground eyeball to eyeball with every other human being, loving every minute of life, because by all rights, we shouldn't be here. By all rights, I shouldn't have been there. And that was the difference between me and them, is that I loved every minute of life today. And my son and I interact the way you taught us to. You taught me how to be a mother. You said, just treat him like you would a newcomer. So when I talk to him, I try to touch him. I look into his eye, and he's getting pretty big now. I used to have to get down on my knees to do that. But I look into his eyes when we talk, and he has his opinion, and I have mine, and there's no right or wrong, and he taught us how to compromise, and he has become my best friend. I just pray to God he gets through adolescence quickly. It's a tough one. I worked with adolescents for 4 years. I am beginning to find out that the things that I told their parents were lies. They work well in theory, but in the home, it doesn't really work well if I don't take it personally. If I don't take it personally, we do fine. If I take it personally, we have two adolescents in the same house, you know, and it's but he's wonderful. He's a product of you. He's a product of Alcoholics Anonymous. He is so full of love and compassion and understanding. And I didn't come here for that. I love it when I see kids in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe they had the worst of our alcoholism, and I believe they deserve the best of our recovery. And it begins here. I remember he wanted to have his ear pierced. Now, I don't know what your attitude is on ear piercing. I don't mind men who have their ears pierced. But he was only about 11. I thought, an 11-year-old with a pierced ear is not okay with me. He wanted to have his ear pierced, and I had been to one Al-Anon meeting. So I looked at him and I said, "Well, it's your ear," and didn't say any more. I didn't offer to have it done for him. I just, "Well, it's your ear." And he turned around and walked away, and I thought, "Well, that worked well." So the next time he brought it up, I said, "Well, it's your ear," and that was the end of it. And then I went away for a weekend. And I came home on Sunday night, and see, he knows me real well. He knows it's important for me to look good in front of you. He knows I'm not going to lose it in front of you. So he met me when I came home Sunday at my Sunday night AA meeting. He met me there, and he came running up to me, and he had his ear pierced. And he was right, I didn't lose it in front of you. And I hated that thing. I hated that earring. I wouldn't look at it. I would look at the other side of his face when I talked to him. When I'd go to bed at night, I'd go by his room, and if his little ear was up, I'd go in and turn his head over in bed in case I had to go by there in the middle of the night, and I hated it. And then he went out to Little League tryouts, and he went to Little League tryout, and he came home, and he said his coach told him he had to take his earring out, and I lost it. "So what do you mean you have to take your earring out? That is your earring, that is your ear, that man doesn't have any right to tell you what you can and can't do, and who does he think he is?" And I finally, I'm quacking away, and I look at him, and he's got this look on his face, and I said, well, what do you think about it? He says, "Well, I think it's really stupid, but I want to play baseball, so I'll take the earring out." It has never been that simple for me. It has never been that, oh, I'm dying of alcoholism. I think I'll stop drinking come to AA. Oh, I'm in a tremendous amount of pain. I think I'll work with a newcomer. Oh, things are really rough. I think I'll write a little in. It has never been that easy for me. I kick, I scream, I fight, I carry on. I have done everything wrong in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've slept with newcomers, and I intend to do it again. I have taken your inventory and shared it with everybody I know. I charged once for a 12-step call. I have done everything wrong. When the lady took a year of cake, I gave her back her $100. So I always have to say that. But I have done everything wrong in Alcoholics Anonymous. The thing I have done right is I haven't drank, and I haven't left. And if you're new or relatively new, I want you to know it often takes a lot of courage to not drink and to not leave Alcoholics Anonymous. It takes a lot of courage to stay here and to live life on life's terms. And not the deals, not the flat tires, not the losing jobs. I mean, everybody goes through that. If you drank like I did, your feelings are so frozen that as those feelings start to thaw and you start to feel, it takes a lot of courage to not drink and to stay here. I hear people say it hasn't been necessary for me to take a drink. I'm going to tell you it has been necessary. It has been urgently necessary. It has been direly necessary. It's been an emergency necessary for me to drink since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. The miracle is that regardless of how necessary it's been, I haven't drank and I haven't used since I came to my first meeting on October 4th, 1975, and I never planned to stay this long. Never planned to stay this long. My life is full today. I just recently started a new job that is something beyond my wildest imagination, and I have a real wild imagination. I'm a little alcoholic yet. They want me to wear a beeper. I told my boss the only thing I can think that a beeper is good for is if you're on a boring date. You can reach in, make a beep, excuse yourself, leave for an appropriate amount of time, come back and say, God, I'm really sorry, but I have to go to the office. I'm still a little rebellious. I haven't hooked my beeper on yet. But this job that I have is absolutely incredible. I recently was able to change the nature of a relationship with a friend to something a little more serious, and to be able to be there and to show up without the walls. I have never been able to do that before. I have women in my life that I love and who love me. I have men in my life that I love and who love me. And it can't happen for somebody like me. It absolutely cannot happen that I can allow you to love me. I have to keep a wall up. I have to keep you away, because if you get too close, you're going to hurt me. I can love you and I can let you love me, and that can't happen to somebody like me. It's absolutely impossible. My life has never been so good. I have never, ever had it so good, and if I'd had it my way, I'd have still changed myself. And before I close, I need to tell you that Alcoholics Anonymous isn't for everybody. I have a woman that I sponsored who has also become a very close friend of mine. Who's 2.5 years sober. She was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous when her mother was in treatment. And she went through a family week with her mother in treatment, and in that family week realized that she had a problem with alcohol herself, and has been sober since then, and a very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And her mother didn't stay sober. And a lot of times the people who bring us here don't stay sober. And her mother didn't stay sober, and this woman was really obsessed with her mother. And my thought always was, and what I would say to her is, where there's life, there's hope. And her mother went to treatment several times, and went to hospitals and detox several times, and I talked to her a lot, and she kept telling me that Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't for her. Alcoholics Anonymous is fine for you, Patty, she'd say, but Alcoholics Anonymous isn't for me. And she didn't need us, and then she would drink, and then she'd end up, and she drank in her apartment, and my friend would go and check on her every once in a while, and I would say, Linda, where there's life, there's hope. Your mother will be okay, and she'd go to treatment again. And Betty and I went to lunch, and then I went up. I did the no-no. I went outside and walked around. And I went up to my room, and the light was on. I had a message, and I did call yesterday. I called my son and told him the number. Where I was, and I called another friend of mine, and that's new for me. I don't want you to know where I am, but I want people to know where I am today. And the light was, and I called down to the desk, and this friend of mine had called, and she had gone over this morning to visit her mother, and her mother was right. She didn't need Alcoholics Anonymous. Her mother was laying in her apartment, half under the bed, and her mother was dead. And Linda had gone over and seen her on Monday, and Monday she was drunk. And she went by to see her today, and she went in and found her mother dead. And she didn't need us. She didn't need Alcoholics Anonymous. And I talked with her on the phone right before I came down here, and I have a lot of fun in Alcoholics Anonymous. I love you. I love this program. I love the laughter. I love the fooling around. I love the hugs. I love all of it. I need to remember every once in a while that we have a disease that kills us. We have a disease that left untreated kills us. I believe that where there's life, there's hope. I believe that if we're in this room, there's a part of us that wants to live more than wants to die. I heard a speaker one time end his pitch by saying, God bless you. And I look around the room of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know where we should all be. We should all be where that woman was this morning. I should be sitting on a bar stool dying of the disease of alcoholism. I should be laying in the gutter somewhere, dreaming dreams, planning plans, thinking if only, knowing that just as soon as that I'm going to do this. And by my own devices, that's where I should be. And yet I'm sober in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're sober in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that we've all been blessed, and that we all have hope, and that we're all here to share our experience, strength, and hope. And that if I don't have enough courage to stay, I can borrow some of yours. And if I take your hand and walk with you, that I'm going to be all right. And when I hear it, when I'm sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I know that I'm safe. And I know that I'm going to be okay. And I know that I'm going to walk out with a little more than I came in with. And I'm going to take a little from each of you, and I'm going to take it home with me. And I want to thank you for participating in my recovery this afternoon. And I want to end with that man that told me that if I didn't drink, I wouldn't get drunk. I found out he was sober longer than I had been alive. And that shows you what my judgment of people was like. I thought he was shooting heroin. And he died when I was 2 years sober, and I made a commitment that if I ever had an opportunity to share in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would carry the message that he carried to me. So I want to end with a little story, and then I want to tell you one more time what Dick said. And the story is the man that goes to see St. Peter, and he asks St. Peter to show him heaven and hell. And St. Peter takes him into a room, and there's long tables in this room. And on the tables is food, any kind of food you could think of, as much food as you could ever imagine. And the people in that room sitting in all that food, and I don't know if I even said this, on the outside of the door it said hell, and he went in. And the people in that room were sitting amongst all that food, and they were starving, and they were hungry, and they were dying. And the reason that they were starving is they had long wooden spoons tied to their hands, and the spoons were a little bit too long, and they couldn't quite get the food to their mouth. So they sat amongst plenty, and they were dying. And that's how I was when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was sitting amongst plenty, and I was dying. And then he took him next door to a room marked heaven, and inside that room was exactly the same thing. Tables and tables and tables of food. As much food as you could think of, any kind of food you could ever imagine. And the people in that room had those long wooden spoons tied to their hands too, and the spoons were just a little bit too long, and they couldn't quite get the food to their mouth. But those people were full, and they were happy, and they were content. And the difference was is that one man was taking a spoonful of food, and he was feeding the man across the table. And he was taking a spoonful of food and feeding the person next to him, and she was feeding somebody else. And that's how Alcoholics Anonymous works for me. I don't have my own answers. I have to come here, and I have to let you feed me. And hopefully every once in a while I have an opportunity to give a spoonful of this thing away to somebody else. And you don't have to have a year or 5 years or 10 years. If you got one day, you have something to feed to the man or woman walking through the door. And that's how it works for me. I want to close with what Dick said to me, if you don't drink, you won't get drunk. If you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And the other thing that I know, because it has been my experience, is in the portion of chapter 5, the line in there that says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Thank you.